the Pentagon. It's got diehard anti-Soviets from way back and others all pushing him that he has to do things in a certain way. He's got lobbies saying that, you know, you can't desert our Ukrainian or our Georgian brothers like this. Putin doesn't have to worry about that. What he says pretty much goes. He you know, obviously has to take account of Russian public opinion, but it's not serious in the same way. But the other part is, you know, the geopolitical reality is that Russia is small cheese. I mean, it's got a GDP of about Canada. It's sort of Saudi Arabia with nuclear missiles in many ways. So it's got some loose cash. Its industrial base is ruined. And one of the reasons for the resentment from the people in Moscow is the they listened to the Americans who helped them ruin it. It was the American economic advisors who crashed the Soviet economy with Gorbachev and afterwards, who reduced Russia to a state of a near penury and therefore powerlessness. So now they have a military, they have nuclear weapons, they have a certain degree of spread, and they're trying to assert themselves. So, you know, in that sense, the fact that Biden is coming along to shake hands with them without being condescending and is prepared to talk to them as equals goes quite a long way, I think, because there's a lot of bruised egos in there. If ever you've spoken to the senior people like Sergei Lavrov, the way they were treated in the Bush years and the Clinton years was bruising, really bruising for their egos and for their national pride. So anything that goes to the way of stroking to get them back up again is good, but that doesn't detract from the very real issues. I mean, Putin is no pussycat. He's not really a nice person. You just ask after the Ukrainians and the Georgians and the other people, the Moldovans and the other people with Russian troops on their territories, to see that he is not exactly the paragon of virtue and multilateralism that he gets painted by some of his supporters. But then Biden and the US are hardly paragons of international virtue, are they? I mean, on every level. So the idea that they're talking as equals without trying to score points on one level is fine. But at the moment, there's no substantial basis. There's no substantial basis for a war, but then there's no substantial basis for a kiss and make up, because, you know, what are the Russians going to offer? Okay, you can have Ukraine and Georgia back. Right. They're not going to do that.
Okay, well, those are two extreme stances there, kiss and make up and war. But let's, George Tomielli, see at what the U.S. has said, which is what Putin actually said in this press conference in terms of the viewpoint that the U.S. has on Russia, publicly declaring Russia to be an enemy that needs to be contained. So Biden goes into that summit with Putin saying that in the press conference. Do you think that that stance has changed after the summit?
Well, not really. let's remember that for the past 5 years, particularly during the Trump years, any attempt on the part of the Trump administration to implement what was the platform on which Trump ran in 2016, namely to improve relations with Russia, was absolutely prohibited because the Democratic Party establishment, much of the media, which is in cahoots with the Democratic Party establishment, and to be honest, also much of the Republican Party as well, regarded any attempt to improve relations with Russia as selling out to Putin, selling out to Russia, demonstrating that Trump was a traitor, an agent of Putin's, a puppet of Putin's, a puppy of Putin's, as Biden himself said. So these were accusations made by Biden himself, Obama, and much of the Democratic Party. So now that Biden is in office, it's suddenly a different story, and apparently it's all about strategic stability, and so it makes sense to talk to Russia. Well, of course it makes sense, and it made sense during the Trump years to talk to Russia. And so that was, it should have been done during the Trump years, and it's right that Biden is doing it now. The point, however, is this. Russia has very legitimate security concerns. It has legitimate security concerns because of NATO expansion. And the NATO expansion has scooped up every single state that had been aligned with the Soviet Union. It has scooped up republics that had been a part of the Soviet Union. NATO in 2008 had promised NATO membership to Ukraine and to Georgia. NATO is clearly still promising continued NATO expansion to take on board all, not just Ukraine and Georgia, but the Central Asian republics. NATO also wants to take on board Belarus in the hope that they, presumably, that they can get rid of Lukashenko in the meantime. NATO, and that means the United States, walked away from the ABM treaty in 2002. NATO walked away from the INF treaty. That was 2 years ago. NATO walked away from the Open Skies Treaty. Russia has a legitimate, very serious security concerns. And Putin certainly, the Russians feel very aggrieved about it. This is nothing to do with egos and making it a sort of a childish psychological exercise. These are serious security concerns. And the reason why there has been a development of a close relationship between Russia and China is that both powers are concerned about Western encroachment and Western aggression. But this bloc, this Russia-China bloc, is a very serious bloc, and it signals a major geopolitical shift during the coming decades against the West and toward this Russia-China bloc.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Interesting that you say that. So let's talk about the security concerns Ian Williams, that our guest there, talks about. Obviously, there's lots of reasons that Russia feels that way, and they obviously appear legitimate. But it was very interesting when the U.S. President Joe Biden talked and just touched on a couple of phrases that you would think would be very serious, but he kind of just touched on it and just moved on. And that was, in so many words, were there to be an accidental military encounter or an accidental war? When he puts things into that context, does that mean that there is a possibility of something like that happening between the U.S., either directly or indirectly through NATO, with Russia? Is that what he may have been referring to?
Well, yes, the forces are poised on a sort of hot, cold war basis. The NATO forces are sort of testing Russian defenses. Russian aeroplanes are going out over Scandinavia and the North Sea and testing Western defenses. There's plenty of scope for, miscalculation. The whole thing about Ukraine and Georgia and the Caucasus. There's lots of room for miscalculation. So, you know, there needs to be a stand down. Now, the strategic part of this is that I can't help seeing an analogy that Russia is now in the position that Britain was at the end of World War II. It's the junior party to China. And if it cozies up to China, it has to accept that it's the junior party and it is a junior partner. And it's tying its flag. It hasn't worked out that well for the British, by the way, tying their flag to the Americans. It's got them consumably ruined their economy, weakened their defenses, and alienated them from Europe. Apart from that, it's doing fine. And it's the same craving for great power status that the actual economy and military power doesn't merit, which I think we can see in operation. And I do have to say that this love affair between Trump and Putin, it was so good that it was Trump who walked away from all of those treaties alienating the Russian military establishment. It was Trump who wanted to get out of the ABM and the various international treaties. So, you know, the point about Trump, of course, is he had his own motives, and they weren't geopolitical. I'm fairly sure that there was money involved, there were favors involved, and it wasn't because he was pro-Russian, it's because he was pro-Trump, and he wanted things, and people in Russia were prepared to give them to him, and he was prepared to play up to it. That's been very, very clear. The man is absolutely cynical and apolitical and unpatriotic, I think you can say, if you organize a mob to storm your own capital on the transition. So, you know, let's say the least glorious episode of American relations was under Trump, where he didn't raise any of the issues that might have hurt his personal political economic power. But he managed to pull out of the treaties, which was far more devastating.
Okay. George Samioli, very interesting when the issue of human rights came up, because the fact that I'm saying that is due to the way that Biden, when he delivered any of the other statements, it seemed like his passion came out when the issue of human rights came up. And he said, and I'm quoting him, made it clear to Putin, we will continue to raise issues of fundamental human rights. We need some basic rules to follow or abide by. And he said that no U.S. president could keep faith with American people if they did not defend democratic values. And, of course, lots of references there made to Navalny, of how important that is for the U.S. Putin had his own things to hit back the U.S. with, like the Black Lives Matter movement, like the insurrection that took place on Capitol Hill. I mean, does the U.S. have even a footing really to address Navalny and then say these things to Putin when Putin had what he said in return? I mean, who's in the right here?
Well, of course the United States doesn't have any basis for raising any of those issues. I mean, in the first place, it is a matter of domestic affairs within Russia. There was a trial. Navalny was on trial. It was an embezzlement case. Now, if Biden, if the State Department has evidence that this was a bogus trial and that this was all fraudulent, then present the evidence. Tell us why it is wrong for the court to convict Navalny of embezzlement. But nobody ever does this. I mean, they just simply repeat the thing, oh, that it's a matter of trumped-up charges, because it's just easy to come up with a slogan. But if you are going to say, we have a right to comment on Russia's internal affairs, we have a right to comment on the human rights situation in Russia, because we are signatories of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, then fine. Then everybody gets to have a right to comment on the internal affairs of every other country. And of course, when the Russians and the Chinese bring that up and said, okay, fine, let's invoke the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and then let's bring up, let's say, what happened to the people on January the 6th. They said, well, you've now got 480 cases being brought. Not one person, not one case has actually been brought to trial. There are people being held in solitary confinement. They're being denied bail, even though the charges against them are basically misdemeanors. What does the Universal Declaration of Human Rights say about that? Well, it says that everyone has a right to an expeditious trial. In other words, it's a fundamental human right not to have governments just dangling charges against you in perpetuity in order to terrorize, intimidate, and demoralize the public. So, yeah, absolutely. If the United States starts bringing up Navalny or any other human rights issue, Russia and China made clear in Anchorage, they are going to do exactly the same to say, well, what's your human rights situation? Where do you get off
right
lecturing us when you are violating the Universal Declaration of Human Rights?
Okay, on a number of occasions, okay. I saw you shaking your head there. Ian Williams, go ahead.
Well, I just like to think of comparisons. The Russians were, in fact, inviting Biden to crash down on Black Lives Matter. The fact that Biden is supporting Black Lives Matter is, to me, a plus for him. I'm very dubious about him. His support for human rights does not extend very closely to Palestinian human rights in general, for example. However, I have to say that if a group of insurgents had stormed the Kremlin and killed the guards on the gate, then
they wouldn't kill the guards. Stop lying. That is not true. That has been established as not true. And please don't put out lies like this.
The footage
it is
being shown
a lie. It has been established that the man died of a stroke. He had two blood clots. He died of a stroke. Please don't lie.
Attacking the civilian staff in there, who carrying banners asking to hang, they wouldn't have lasted a second with Putin. They'd have been gunned down before they got to the gate, and you know it.
Okay, well, let's move on to another issue because we're quickly running out of time here. And George Samioli, let me turn over to you, and that is the issue of cybersecurity. And it seems like Biden did actually have somewhat of a plan based on what he said about having 16 infrastructure-type approaches towards this cybersecurity. But it was very interesting for Putin to say that number one on the list of countries that actually have cyber attacks emanate from, it's the U.S., then Canada, which was a surprise. I'm sure many maybe didn't know that. and then the UK was there also. Do you think that, how do you view or how do you assess the way that these two talked about cybersecurity?
Well, that's a promising area for mutual cooperation. And again, the Russians have brought this up for many years. And ever since the, well, even before the 2016, I mean, they said, look, you're accusing us of interfering in your election. Show us your evidence and let's discuss issues of cybersecurity. And I think that does make a lot of sense, that this is a very dangerous area in which, the cyber hacking and the cyber hacking. I mean, hacking is part of espionage, no question, everybody does it. Russia does it, United States does it, Canada does it, everybody does it. Cyber attacks with a view to sabotaging strategic institutions, whether it's nuclear power stations, hydroelectric dams and whatever, banks or something that could cause very serious damage to civilians, that's a different issue. And I think that some way of working out a modus vivendi on cybersecurity, I mean, if that happens, I doubt whether it will happen, but if it does happen, then it's all to the good.
Okay. Final question goes to you, Ian Williams. You know, when you take a look at the two countries, there are so many areas that they cross paths on that it would warrant, in some respects, their cooperation, which then would probably win over those conflict areas. You could talk about Syria. Perhaps you could talk about Iran in some sense. You could talk about a whole host of other issues here. But it doesn't seem like the U.S. is on that path. It's more confrontational with Russia. And based on what you have seen in this summit, do you think that the U.S. is going to continue that confrontational path with Russia, or will it cherry-pick or pick certain areas that they can cooperate on?
Look, both sides have been confrontational. I mean, the Russians have confronted and tweaked and done things. I've no doubt at all that the Russians are involved in cyber warfare, but so is the U.S. I mean, you just have to ask the Iranians about their centrifuges and who crashed them. The U.S. is practically boasting about it, and so they can hardly complain if somebody does it to them. But of course, this is the big problem in both cases, especially in the U.S. case. You know, how dare you do what I'm doing? Of course the U.S. has interfered in elections in the sense of providing support for democratic groups. I don't believe it's fiddled with the vote in these countries yet. But, for them to raise their hands and say, oh, no, non-interference, and then go interfering in other places all over the world, it is, to say the least, hypocritical. They're both, it's the pot calling the kettle black, as we say in the old English saying. And, you know, a lot of what they're accusing Russia of is what they're doing. They are the ones pushing up against the Russian border. The Russians are pushing back at the expense of the neighbors, the Ukrainians and the Georgians and the Moldovans and the others. But it's still, there's room for push and shove on both sides. And the real point is that Russia, because of the perestroika and the fall afterwards, suffered a catastrophic loss in power and economic power and military power, and the world has not yet adjusted to it. I don't think the Russians have, and the Americans are unrelenting and carrying on pushing.
Thank you very much for that.
Unfortunately,
I got to jump in because we're fresh out of time. Sorry, Ian Williams. Thank you for that. Ian Williams there, Senior Analyst at Foreign Policy and Focus. Thank you so much for your thoughts. Also, George Samueli, thank you, Senior Research Fellow at Global Policy Institute. And with that, we come to an end with this edition of The Debate. From Mikhail Tehran, the entire team in the capital of Tehran, it's goodbye.
That permission, Shahid said, after praising Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and the Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, he says that our respectable son Hujjatul Islam wal Muslimin Sayyid Mahmud Hashimi has spent a long time of his life learning fiqh usul and theological studies. so that he has succeeded to become a mujtahid on whom Islam and the Muslims may rely.
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmud Shahrudi was living in Najaf. This was because, I mean, the ex-Baathist regime hadn't devastated the whole Najaf seminary. And another one is that Najaf was in some way the hub of all the Shiite world.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is the teacher and analysis on the thoughts and works of the most outstanding jurists, philosophers, and thinkers of the Nation of Islam all across the world. I'm Atal, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers, Dr. Muhammad Reza Fakhr Rouhani, a faculty member of the University of Qom. Assalamu alaikum, Doctor.
Assalamu alaikum.
And Sayyid Mohsen Naghwi, an Islamic scholar from the Islamic House of Qom. Assalamu alaikum, brother. Welcome to the show.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah.
So today we want to continue our discussion regarding the character of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmud Hashemi Shahrudi. In our previous discussions, we talked about his lineage, his background, and his scholarly and academic, you know, character, especially his main fields of studies in the terms of Islamic, we can say, principles, usul al-fiqh, fiqh. We can say he was one of the students and one of maybe the best students, among the best students of Shaheed Muhammad Baqir Assad. But Sayyid Mohsen Naghwi, regarding the political life and the political activities of Ayatollah Mahmud Hashemi Shahrudi, both in Iraq and Iran, there are so many documents. He was a political activist in both Iraq at the time of Baath regime and then in Iran. Talk a little bit about his political activities for us, brother.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, as we know that he was one of the most prominent and close students of Shaheed Saad.
Definitely.
Since Shaheed Saad has Hizbut Da'wah, which was against the Baath regime, and they have these activities, Ayatollah Shahrudi was also involved in those activities from the very beginning. And but we can see, like, even in the history that in 1974, the Baath regime, because of his activities that he had against the Baath regime and the Saddam's regime, they imprisoned him, and he was in prison.
Okay.
After that, we see that when the Islamic Revolution occurred in 1979, first late Ahmad Khomeini was the link between the Imam Khomeini and Shaheed Saad, and later it was Ayatollah Shahrudi,
okay,
late Shahrudi, who was a link between them, and he used to, you know, bring the messages for Shaheed Saad. And if I want to just quickly summarize the activities that he had in Iraq, after the martyrdom of Shaheed Sadr, basically he became a prominent leader for the Iraqi, we can say, Shias, or the those who were against the Baath regime. And
at the time of Baath regime, the Shias were banned from holding
all
gatherings.
Yes.
So there were great ulamas on that time in Hawza. Hawza was active on that time in Basra?
Hawza was active, and that was only for the educational cause. So they couldn't have the political, you know, speeches. Same was the case in Iran as well.
Mm-hmm.
Like at the time of the Shah Pahlavi, it was allowed for the scholars to have their lectures in the Hawza, but they were not allowed to talk about politics.
Okay.
You know, this was the secular thinking was within these, we can say, the secular thinking was within these, you know, rulers of the time.
That's right.
And what made Imam Khomeini prominent from other scholars at the time of, before the revolution, it was that Imam Khomeini raised his voice against the things that were going on in the country.
That's right.
And he basically got involved in the politics of the country. Same is the case with the Shaheed Sadr in Iraq.
Right.
Why Saddam killed Shaheed Saad? Because he came and he basically started talking about the politics.
That's right.
And he was basically intervening in the political issues of
That's
that
right.
time for the weak, you know, people of the Iraqi, like the Iraqi people. And we can see the same activities that late Ayatollah Shahrudi followed the same
That's
footsteps
right.
of
the
his
footsteps.
Teachers.
We get to Majlis Ala, you know, in Iraq by Ayatollah Hashemi Shahrudi. Established by him, in fact. Dr. Fakhrouhani, brother, you yourself had many travels to Iraq, especially the cities of Najaf and Karbala, and we know that the Baath regime had such a pressure over there they martyred so many members of the great families. It's called the families in Iraq and banned so many others. Ayatollah Hashemi Shahrudi was among, we can say, those scholars who had to leave the country, Iraq, for Iran because of the vast pressures over there. Talk a little bit about the political atmosphere of Iraq during the Ba'ath regime and Saddam regime, and why Ayatollah Shahrudi left over there.
Yes, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In order to discuss this point, it's necessary to go back and to refer to what our brother Sayyid Mohsen Naghvi has already referred to. We find that when shortly after the 1920 revolution in Iraq, we find that several dynasties, Arab dynasties, came to power in Iraq, mainly in Baghdad. At first, a great majority of them had British leanings, and later on, with the upcoming of the ex-Soviet powers, we find that leftists and Marxists got to power, okay? Now we find that, apart from the Sunni-populated areas of Iraq, when we come to the Shia parts, we find that leftists and especially communists, Marxists, wanted to propagate the teachings in the Shia-populated areas. At this time, we find that among the great and renowned ulamas in Najaf, we find that the late Ayatollah Sayyid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr was one of the most prodigious scholars who felt this threat and developed many books. And the back scenario of his writing the book Falsafatuna, or philosophy, was that the late Ayatollah Sayyid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr wanted to highlight that the Islamic creedal system and the Islamic mindset is much superior to other frameworks already presented to people.
That's
as
right.
The savior of nations. Okay. At that time, because the ex-Ba'athist regime had apparently leftist inclinations and leanings, but in fact they were connected both to Americans and to Russians.
Okay.
And for the intelligence system, they benefited from the British and the Zionists at the same time.
Okay.
They benefited from everywhere who were against Islam. They felt the threat of the late Shaykh Sayyid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr, and not only the threat of the Shaykh Sayyid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr, but also the threat they felt from the close associates of the late Shaykh Sayyid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr.
Including Ayatollah Shahrudi.
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
We find that first they arrested and then martyred the late Shaykh Sayyid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr, Ayatollah Sayyid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr, and almost at the same time or shortly afterward, they wanted to follow up and to chase and pursue the close associates of the late Ayatollah Shaykh Sayyid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr. And it's because of this that the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmoud Shahrudi first from Iraq went to Kuwait, and then from Kuwait he migrated back to Iran, okay, to his paternal homeland.
And were there any members of Ayatollah Shahrudi martyred in Iran?
There were three brothers.
Really?
Yes. Yes.
His three brothers,
wow.
They got martyred by the Ba'ath regime, and they were involved in the political activities at that time.
Ayatollah Shahrudi's three brothers were martyred.
Yes.
Yes.
Wow.
And they were students in Baghdad, at the University of Baghdad.
One of them was a student, another had a business.
Has a business?
Yes, so. Had a business in Karbala.
Okay.
And there was another who was also, I think he also had a business, but they all three, because they were so much active in the riots against the Ba'ath regime.
That's
and
right.
in the activities. So first they imprisoned them, and after them, obviously, they got martyred. And the interesting thing is that all three of them, the family has not received till today their dead bodies, and they don't know where they are. They were imprisoned by the Ba'ath regime, and where they took them, no one knows about them.
Yes, it was quite prevalent in Iraq at that time. Okay,
The killing of the scholars and the family
killing
members.
Killing and burning the body and so on.
Oh.
Or, for example, putting the whole body in acids, for example.
Oh.
Yes.
That's all right. So, living under such circumstances in Iraq was really difficult, especially for scholars who could see, for example, that Islam talks about justice, Islam talks about the human rights and this and that, and then you'd have no chair or no place in order to express yourself, only the academic fields of studies. And was it based on the order or suggestion of Ayatollah Baghra Saad that Ayatollah Shardi left Iran?
No, basically it was after the martyrdom of Shahid Saad.
That's right. Yes. Okay,
and it was generally, he basically moved back to Iran, yes, before him.
Mm-hmm.
And that was because in 1974 when he got imprisoned, with the reference of a couple of maraji of that time and the pressure of the ulama, he was freed by the Ba'ath regime. Mm-hmm. And after that, obviously, I think it was Shahid Baghr al-Sadr as well, like, who basically said to him to move to Iran.
That's right.
And that's how he became the link between the Shahid Sadr and Imam Khomeini.
And what was this Islamic Supreme Council of Iraq, which was established by... Was he the main establisher of that?
He was one of the main people who was involved in establishing that.
Okay.
But actually, it was the Hakim family.
Mm-hmm.
And Shahid Sayyid Muhammad Bakr al-Hakim was the main person who was behind it. And they made this council against the Ba'ath regime, and it was obviously in today's world we can say at the moment we can say currently the most of the seats that were taken by a political we can say group in the parliament of Iraq is from the same group.
Okay.
Although the Hakim family was the one who basically started this group, but we can see the first president of this group was late Ayatollah Shahroudi.
Mm-hmm.
And after 30 months, when he moved to Iran, then Sayyid Bakr al-Hakim took he became the chairman. After him, his brother Abdul Aziz, and now it's Ammar al-Hakim.
That's right.
Who is the in charge of the group.
So and this majlis has specific roles. I mean, and that time especially.
Yeah, that time it was against the Ba'ath regime. Also, it has some charitable, we can say institutes.
Okay.
It's supporting the
That's
schools.
Right.
It has
That's
its own schools.
Okay.
There are the libraries that mm-hmm. they built because one of the reasons that there was a need of making. Such a majlis was because the Ba'ath regime wasn't thinking about the welfare of the people.
Mm-hmm.
And since they were not thinking about the welfare of people and they were just after governing and having their own rulership over the people, so people from inside who had pain for the Iraqi general public,
that's right.
Which is mostly from, it has come from the same ulama,
okay.
like the scholars in the Najaf and Karbala. So they raised their voice, they started these activities,
that's right.
and they started to develop the charitable institutes
mm-hmm.
to help the poor people. They started schools, because schools were not there, especially in the Shia, we can say, places where there were more Shias, they were oppressed by these Ba'ath regime, and they never wanted them to be become literate.
Okay.
So that that's one of the main things about the rulers, the cruel rulers, that they do not want people to get educated, because when they get educated, they can raise their voice against what's happening.
Okay.
So they want them to be illiterate, do not know about anything, and then they can rule the country.
Right. We know that in Iran, the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmoud Hashemi Shahroudi was the head of the judiciary and the judicial system in Iran. And the new look that he had, I think, at the judicial power in Iran was absolutely based on the maktab of Shahid Assad. And, one of the great things that he had done was the change of the concept of imprisonment for the prisoners and the criminals in Iran, because he believed that, according to the Fiqh of Shia, this imprisoning itself has the negative consequences, influence on the soul and the spirit of the people. He tried as best as possible to replace it with the other, we can say, punishments. And the other great things that he had done, regarding the new look that he had in the judicial system in Iran, started with Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmoud Hashemi Shahroudi, and then the next generations of the head of the judiciary system continued that path. Thank you much,
You're
Dr. Fakhwani. Nothing to add, brother, to
no.
this field. Okay, and Zaid Mohsen Naghvi. Thank you much too for being present in the program. The teacher, it was very kind of you. In three episodes, we tried to cover the character of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmud Hashemi Shahrudi. May Allah bless his soul. Because of a disease, you know, he passed away. The prayer on his body was led by the leader of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, and then his body was taken to the holy shrine of Hazrat Masuma in the holy city of Qom, and he was buried in Balasar Mosque in the vicinity of the shrine of Hazrat Masuma in the holy city of Qom. May Allah bless his soul, and we really missed him, and we could really benefit from him so much more. And unfortunately, he passed away because of a disease. Thank you very much, Sayyid Mohsen and Dr. Fakhrani, and thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program, The Teacher. Do not forget to visit our website at parstoday.com/Ian Call of Islam page. Also, our YouTube channel, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Round the world with reporters.
Palestinians in the Gaza Strip held demonstrations in several parts of the enclave in response to the return of the controversial flag march in East Jerusalem al-Quds. The protesters said the move is aimed at provoking Palestinians' anger. They burnt Israeli flags and vowed to defend Jerusalem al-Quds with all means.
The Israeli regime is responsible for the consequences of its crimes in Jerusalem al-Quds. It's provoking us by holding this flag march. Palestinian resistance in all parts of Palestine announces its readiness to respond to the violations in Al-Aqsa Mosque. The international community should stop such violations.
The extremist flag march passed through the old city's Damascus Gate and entered the Muslim Quarter. This amid a fragile ceasefire in the Gaza Strip following the recent Israeli aggression that claimed nearly 250 Palestinian lives. The flag march caused Hamas to warn that the tensions in the Gaza Strip will break out again after Israel's 11-day escalation on the enclave.
Our Palestinian people are all united in defending Jerusalem al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque. Our message is clear that we will not allow Israel to impose its plans of stealing our land and holy places. We will sacrifice everything for Palestine, and the resistance is ready to fight back. We do not trust any Israeli ceasefire, and we are committed to it as long as Israel keeps it.
Palestinian resistance in Gaza announced its readiness for any conflict against the Israeli regime in response to the violations against Palestinians in Jerusalem al-Quds.
Any Palestinian would feel angry for what is happening in Jerusalem al-Quds and the Israeli violations of our rights. We are all united in facing this occupation. We are supporting the resistance and we are proud of its achievements in defending us. We will not give up Al-Quds and our holy places, and the Israeli plans there will fail because we are the true owners of the land.
The controversial flag march in Jerusalem Al-Quds risks reigniting tensions with Palestinians, both in the occupied territories and the Gaza Strip. Hamas has warned that the march will trigger a new conflict for defending Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
The U.S. State Department's Bureau of Near Eastern Affairs said the U.S. envoy to Yemen has met with the director of USAID to discuss the need for more donors to provide additional humanitarian funding to address the growing crisis in Marib. Experts believe that this step is an attempt by the U.S. to provide new weapons to its tools in Marib, including terrorist groups who protect its agenda in the oil-rich province.
The continued advancement of the Yemeni army toward liberating Marib prompted the United States to use the humanitarian crisis to supply the terrorist groups in Marib with weapons so that the conflict could not be prolonged. U.S. push for peace has no basis in reality, and continued siege on the Yemeni people is a proof.
Observers said the USAID plays a suspicious role wherever it exists, adding that it uses the humanitarian and relief work as a cover-up for its military and intelligence activities.
The U.S. Agency for International Development is an intelligence agency. It shows the humanitarian aspect, but it hides a lot of illegal activities, including supporting terrorist groups with weapons. The United States will not accept peace unless its conditions are met. Washington is the one who leads the war in Yemen and cannot be a peacemaker.
Last year, the Yemeni army found large quantities of weapons carrying the logo of USAID in Al Bayda and Marib front lines after recapturing areas that were controlled by Daesh and Al-Qaeda.
Yemenis believe that the U.S. is directly involved in the deadly war against their country. They say it is their right to liberate their lands from any foreign existence, as well as terrorist groups who serve the interests of the U.S. and Yemen. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
The U.S. troops are fast withdrawing from Afghanistan under a peace deal American had with the Taliban 2 years ago. On the other hand, the Taliban, the militant group who already control nearly 75% territory, is now sieging and capturing districts and regions around the capital city. The Afghan government blames neighboring Pakistan for supporting Taliban's ongoing rapid territorial gains, an allegation Pakistan denies. With the new law in the bilateral ties between Afghanistan and Pakistan, influential former diplomats, think tanks, and politicians from the both sides held a meeting in Islamabad. The objective behind this gathering, better known as Track 2 diplomacy, is to bring down the tension between two countries and help Kabul to find out a peaceful solution. Negotiations between the Taliban and Ashraf Ghani government have resumed in Doha with no progress in sight. The Taliban wants setting up their brand of an Islamic government, while Ashraf Ghani is not willing to accept an interim setup to replace him. The U.S. fears the Taliban could possibly overrun the capital Kabul if President Ashraf Ghani does not strike a peace deal with them.
And the withdrawal obviously will take place, with or without the settlement. God forbid we are sucked back into the 90s and there is anarchy. Civil war. Is that a concern? Yes, it is.
The U.S. has made it clear that Pentagon would not carry out airstrikes from its aircraft carriers outside Afghanistan to prevent Taliban's possible takeover of capital Kabul.
The Americans are tired of this war. They are fatigued, and they want to leave as soon as possible. And they don't want to invest more money, more energy, and they don't want to fight in Afghanistan any longer. Taliban are very confident they will be able to establish their upper hand in any future dispensation.
In a recent interview with a German newspaper, Afghan President Ashraf Ghani said he knows his death is just one bullet away. Analysts believe that his remarks shows on how he perceives the threat of Taliban's violent takeover of capital Kabul after the U.S. lost war and left his government onto the mercy of warring Taliban. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
Based on official statistics, systematic targeting of Shia people in Afghanistan kicked off almost 7 years ago. Since then, over 1,000 Shia civilians have been killed and many others wounded, including women and children, in tens of separate attacks, such as bomb blasts or targeted killings.
Our people face a real systematic genocide, and this trend has drawn a very dark future for us. We have been repeatedly targeted by brutal terrorist attacks, mainly in western Kabul. I think gone are those days when people were killed because of their belief or ethnicity.
However, it seems that the time for killing of Shia people has already arrived for the terrorist groups, mainly Daesh.
This comes as the Afghan presidential palace has promised to implement a comprehensive security plan in western Kabul to tackle security threats there. However, there is still no positive change in the security situation in the Shia-dominated area of western Kabul.
In the latest incident on Saturday evening, two minivans were blown up in western Kabul. The twin blasts claimed the lives of at least seven Shia civilians and wounded more than 10 others. In the meantime, some prominent Shia leaders urged the government to either urgently unveil its own security plan for Western Kabul or approve People's Security Plan to protect Shia people against terrorist attacks and bombings.
The government must provide our people with security, otherwise the situation will get more dangerous. This will force peaceful people to pick up guns once again to protect themselves against violence.
Afghan government blames Taliban for targeting Shia population. Taliban, however, reject the accusation. This comes as Daesh proudly claims responsibility for most of such attacks and even warn of launching more and more attacks on Shia people across the country. Sayed Amin Alami, Kabul.
On the sidelines of the NATO summit in Brussels, Democrats Abroad Belgium held a rally to coincide with the visit of Joe Biden. We sought their views on current efforts to save the JCPOA Iran nuclear deal, which Biden's predecessor, Donald Trump, tried to destroy.
I would actually encourage Biden to make that leap of faith and go ahead and say, listen, we're in, the sanctions are lifted, now it's up to you.
I don't know any more about the outcome than you do, but I'm confident that they're sincere about trying.
I'm crossing my fingers. He's allowed to do at least half of what he's trying to do because there's a lot of obstruction in the Senate, of course.
Inside the summit, calls were made for the 30 countries in NATO to stand strongly together in order to face down current threats.
Especially at a time when authoritarian regimes like Russia and China challenge the rules-based international order.
Moscow and Beijing reject the criticism, and some analysts argue NATO is merely trying to justify its existence by creating adversaries. Also, there are divisions within NATO itself. For example, Turkey and Germany have important economic ties to Russia and China. Even the UK seems to be trying to tone down NATO HQ rhetoric.
I don't think anybody around the table today wants to descend into a new Cold War with China. I don't think that's where people are, but I think people see, they see challenges.
For his part, Joe Biden had this to say about Vladimir Putin ahead of a meeting with the Russian president on Wednesday.
He's bright, he's tough, and I have found that he is as they say, when he used to play ball, a worthy adversary.
There have not been huge protests to coincide with Biden's visit to Belgium. That's in stark contrast to when Donald Trump was here. Clearly, the optics are different on this occasion, but critics of US foreign policy say fundamentally the same problems still exist. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
After more than a decade, Israel has turned the page of Benjamin Netanyahu rule, ushering in a new era with a new coalition cabinet led by Naftali Bennett, the head of the right-wing Yamina party, and Yair Lapid, the leader of Yesh Atid party. However, the Palestinian leadership remains skeptical, saying it expects no changes in Israeli policy towards Palestinians. It says the only difference that could be seen is that former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu will no longer be there. Palestinian officials say they expect the Bennett-Lapid cabinet to be worse than the one it's replacing.
Israel's policies won't change even if a new coalition is taking office. There is no hope for change from the Bennett rule. In my opinion, it's more extreme than the one it's replacing. Bennett is likely to pursue the same right-wing agenda as Netanyahu. And here comes the role of the international community to prevent future aggression and violence against the Palestinians.
Bennett, a former chairman of the Yisha Settlers Council, has long vowed to prevent the establishment of an independent Palestinian state, and he supports the annexation of major parts of the occupied West Bank, as well as expanding settlement construction. Experts say Bennett doesn't believe in a solution to the Palestinian-Israeli conflict and will continue to act this way even if he's not an opposition leader anymore, or at least supposed to be. Israel's new cabinet held a festive first meeting Sunday night following a historic Knesset vote, with 60 members voting in favor, 59 against and 1 abstaining. Bennett urged his ministers to show restraint over the numerous ideological differences between parties in alliance to ensure its stability. Bennett will serve as prime minister first as part of a rotation agreement with Lapid. He will serve alternately as prime minister and foreign minister until the handover of power to Lapid on 27th of August 2023. Experts warn that in an attempt to prolong the life of the new fragile eight-party coalition, Naftali Bennett, the new Israeli prime minister, will exert every possible effort to appease the most extreme elements, especially through the continuation of settlement activities across the occupied territories. Mona Kandil, Occupied Ramallah.
Ngo Dinh Diem, a pro-American, became president of South Vietnam in 1955 and, with the assistance of the U.S., began to arrest anyone suspected of being a member of the Viet Minh Communist Coalition. The U.S. then gradually increased its troop deployment to the country, fearing that communism would soon spread across the region. In 1964, the Gulf of Tonkin incident gave the U.S. government an excuse to justify a war on Vietnam. An intruding U.S. destroyer clashed with North Vietnamese Navy torpedo boats in August of that year. In an ensuing sea battle, one U.S. aircraft and three North Vietnamese torpedo boats were damaged. Also, four North Vietnamese soldiers were killed. As a result, the U.S. Congress then approved the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution, which authorized U.S. military action in the region. After a bloody and protracted war, a truce was struck in 1973, ending direct U.S. involvement and completing the evacuation of American forces, which had grown to 500,000. The war claimed the lives of 58,000 Americans and 4 million Vietnamese. It impacted 700,000 American veterans, cost the U.S. more than $100 billion, and tarnished the country's image and morale at home. However, the true narrative behind the Vietnam War was revealed after then-Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara commissioned a secret history based on classified papers, the Pentagon Papers, in 1967. He formed a research team to assemble and analyze Defense Department decision-making dating back to 1945. An analyst under research, Daniel Ellsberg, eventually disclosed portions of the report to the New York Times, which was published in 1971. The papers revealed that the U.S. had secretly enlarged the scope of its actions in the Vietnam War, with coastal raids on North Vietnam and Marine Corps attacks, none of which were reported in the mainstream media. The Pentagon Papers are an important record of the United States' first defeat in a war. To this day, the United States' failures in the Vietnam War, as well as its atrocities in terms of civilian casualties and the deployment of chemical weapons, have stained America's reputation at home and abroad.
Ashes and rubbles. There is nothing more left as despair has once again taken over Rohingya refugees in New Delhi. A devastating fire has brought down the entire camp to ruins. Around 55 families were residing in the camp. Most of the refugees have escaped unharmed, but all they had has turned into ashes. Now some local NGOs and residents are lending support.
It was around 11:30 in the night yesterday when my children started crying due to the heat of the fire. When I opened my eyes, there was huge smoke and fire. We immediately got out of our shanty and moved to the safety.
The residents of the camp are not sure how the fire started, but an eyewitness said it started in the middle of the camp, and within an hour, everything was on ground, and it took the firefighters a lot of efforts to control it. Rights activists have urged the UN Refugee Agency for prompt response in helping them with every possible way.
I don't know why we are facing all this hardship. Our lives are miserable. We can't live in our own country with dignity. And wherever we go for refuge, hardship follows us. I'm happy to have my child alive. I can't forget the scene I saw yesterday. Even if I close my eyes, it frightens me.
The camp is surrounded by a cluster of shanties where people from all faiths live. Many people I spoke with had a suspicion that either the fire broke out due to a short circuit or it could possibly be a conspiracy to vacate them from the location, since the deportation campaign to expel Rohingya from India has gained momentum in recent years. The blaze has destroyed everything these people have had. Now they have to brave both the harsh heat of the summer and the fear of the COVID-19 pandemic. Their miseries continue to mount with each passing day. In a display of mercy and compassion, scores of neighboring residents and activists from the NGOs reached the spot to lend whatever help they could. Estimates suggest some 40,000 Rohingya refugees are living in India, who are now stuck in limbo amid a vicious campaign to deport them. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Almost 59 million Iranians are eligible to vote in the upcoming 13th presidential elections in Iran. Speaking at the press conference on Monday, head of Iran's election headquarters, Jamal Orf, said out of the more than 59 million eligible voters, there are almost 1,400,000 first-time voters in this round of the elections.
There are almost 59 million eligible voters for the 13th presidential elections, out of which almost 1,400,000 are first-time voters. For the presidential race, we have arranged over 67,000 ballot boxes across the country and 450 more worldwide.
Seven candidates are running in Iran's 13th presidential election due on June 18th. All of them have so far been focusing on the economy battered by sanctions and mismanagement in recent years.
The number of polling stations and voting hours will increase for people to participate in the June 18 presidential elections, to observe health protocols and social distancing rules. Over 5,000 personnel in charge of the election have received the first dose of their COVID-19 vaccines. All agents in polling stations must have a certificate of negative test so as not to spread the virus.
Although some of the contenders have a stronger professional backgrounds, one cannot really tell who holds a better chance to win the top executive post before all candidates lay out their plans. Under the election law, the presidential campaigns of the candidates will come to an end 24 hours before the polls open on June 18th. According to the election headquarters, in more than 100 countries worldwide, there are over 200 polling stations already arranged for the June 18th presidential race. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
Mohammed Al-Attar, a Palestinian teacher, has lost his wife and three children in an Israeli airstrike in his house in North Gaza Strip. Mohammed's four-story building that was a shelter for his entire family totally collapsed to the ground. Mohammed, who used to have a normal life, working at a school and looking after his kids, is now homeless and without a family.
Israeli airstrikes hit our building without any prior notice. I just opened my eyes and found all of us under the rubble. Some of us managed to get out of the rubble. I tried to save my children, but to no avail. I called for help from Civil Defense Service, but it took long till they reached us. I just want to ask the international community and human rights groups, what are our rights? I had a peaceful life and suddenly I became homeless without a family. I lost every hope I used to have.
Hassan Al-Attar, Mohammed's father-in-law, has his own sufferings to tell. Working in the civil defense services, he was surprised with a call informing that his daughter, along with her three kids, were killed by Israeli airstrikes. Staring at the bodies of his daughter and her three children, Hassan bid farewell to his daughter while he was at work trying to pull their bodies from the rubbles.
I was at work when Mohammed called me to tell that Israel bombed his house and my daughter and her three kids were under the rubbles. They weren't ambulances. They were all out on missions and I had to wait for one. When I got to them, their bodies were all out of the rubbles. I don't know why Israel targeted them.
Most Gazans are in need of mental health support following the latest 11-day escalation that killed families in their homes in Gaza. The north parts of the Gaza Strip, along with Beit Hanun and Jabalia, was one of the areas that witnessed bombardment coupled with heavy artillery shelling.